The headlines: Israel continues to target the Gaza Strip with the deadly air raids, prompting fresh retaliatory strikes from Palestinian resistance fighters. Several countries, as well as resistance groups across the region, have reacted to Israel's latest bloodshed in Gaza, warning the regime against further provocations. Plus, China urges the United States to stop escalating tensions over Taiwan following House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's controversial visit to the island. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Israeli airstrikes on the besieged Gaza Strip continue unabated as the regime presses ahead with its acts of aggression against Palestinians. At least two Palestinians were killed on Saturday in an air raid on the city of Khan Yunis in the south of the coastal territory. Sirens also sounded in Israeli settlements near Gaza amid reports of a fresh volley of rockets fired by Palestinian resistance groups in retaliation for Israeli strikes. That came after an earlier air raid by the Israeli regime on Gaza, which killed at least 10 people and wounded nearly 100. Meanwhile, Israeli military says that it was prepared for a week of operations. Islamic Jihad also said that it had rejected Tel Aviv's attempt to ease tensions by sending mediators. Palestinian resistance groups have ruled out any truce, saying the regime must fully pay the price for its actions. Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign says Israeli politicians often compete in killing the highest number of Palestinians in order to succeed in elections.
The in the past, the political competition in the Zionist bloc has often led to attacks on Gaza, has often led to bloodletting. Indeed, during two elections back, Benny Gantz, the moderate, competed with Netanyahu by producing an electoral video asking for Israelis to vote for him, and he included videos of Palestinian funerals, coffins, and in it he said he had bombed Gaza back to the Stone Age and you should vote for him because he would kill more Palestinians. He actually had, during the 2 or 3 minute video, a little counter in the corner of his video saying how many Palestinians he had been responsible for killing during a particular attack on Gaza. It's been a constant of Israeli politics and behavior that they use extreme naked violence against the Palestinian people, quite simply because there's really nothing to negotiate. Either the Palestinians submit, in which case they will continue to be dispossessed every day, every week. There will be more land taken from Palestinians for exclusively Jewish occupation. So if they don't resist, they'll be dispossessed. And if they resist, the Israelis only know the language of violence and they must be crushed. And that's what we're seeing at the moment.
Condemnations are pouring in following Israel's deadly airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi categorically condemned the air raids and said the attacks once again showed the Israeli regime seeks aggression and occupation. He said Palestinians' resistance to expedite Tel Aviv's downfall. Turkey also strongly condemned the air raids. Ankara said it is unacceptable to kill civilians in attacks. Yemen's National Salvation Government and Ansarullah Movement condemned the Israeli airstrikes as well. Ansarullah also reaffirmed Palestinians' right to respond to Israeli aggression. Qatar, Jordan, Algeria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, Iraq's Khatib Hezbollah group, and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation have also condemned the attacks. Moving on, China's foreign minister has urged the United States not to escalate the tensions between the two countries, which have soared to new highs over the flashpoint island of Taiwan.
America's habit is to create a problem and then use this problem to achieve its goals, but this approach will not work with China. We want to issue a warning to the U.S. not to act rashly and not to create a bigger crisis. The U.S. says China has changed the status quo of the Taiwan Strait situation. This is false and smearing. What is the Taiwan Strait status quo? Taiwan is part of China. It is never a country. There is only one China. This has been the case since ancient times.
China's foreign ministry also slammed U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. The ministry said her trip interfered with China's internal affairs and undermined the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Beijing has ruled out the countermeasures against the U.S., which includes ending military talks between Chinese and U.S. defense leaders. The new measures were announced hours after Beijing imposed sanctions on Pelosi. This as China held a second day of its largest ever military drills around Taiwan, which the U.S. has condemned.
The People's Liberation Army has now declared 7 restricted zones near Taiwan and say that they will extend a range of military exercises through Monday. These provocative actions are a significant escalation.
Meanwhile, Pelosi has reaffirmed Washington's support for the island, adding that the U.S. will not allow China to isolate Taiwan. The House Speaker, however, explained her trip was not aimed at changing the status quo in the island. Relations between China and the U.S. have soured over a host of issues, including trade, the South China Sea, and Taiwan. China sees Taiwan as part of its territory and has already warned Washington against playing with fire, vowing to punish those who anger Beijing.
With her trip to Taiwan this week, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi set off a firestorm in offending China. From the self-governing territory, Pelosi criticized Beijing and its leadership, while carefully outlining the limitations of the U.S. commitment to defend the island.
In the Congress, House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans are committed to the security of Taiwan in order to have Taiwan be able to most effectively defend themselves. But it also is about our shared values of democracy and freedom and how Taiwan has been an example to the world in that regard.
China had warned the U.S. and Pelosi against the visit, as it views Taiwan as a breakaway province that will one day rejoin a one China. In response to Pelosi's Taiwan visit, China's People's Liberation Army on Thursday began the largest military exercises targeting Taiwan in decades. In South Korea, Pelosi met with the Speaker of the National Assembly. Seoul has been careful to balance its U.S. military alliance and relations with its largest trading partner, China. Pelosi spoke with South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol on the phone, but the two did not meet, an outcome widely viewed as a snub of the third-ranked U.S. official. House Speaker Pelosi later stopped in Japan, where she met with Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. China later Friday announced sanctions against Pelosi and the suspension on several issues of cooperation with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Ukraine war has changed the world order, and one of the reasons behind that is the fallout between Russia and the West. One organization says Russia's cooperation with the West is essentially now over. Russia says that it would never trust the West again. The key question is who will be left behind or will suffer more as a result.
The war in Ukraine has created massive political and geostrategic shifts in alliances at regional and international levels. The war has now brought back the specter of the Cold War to the global scene. Russia, which is at loggerheads with the United States and its Western allies, says the era of constructive cooperation between Russia and Western countries is irrevocably over. Moscow says the end of the partnership is regardless of the result of the war in Ukraine. Regardless of the duration and outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Well, in politics, nothing is definite and irreversible, as we know. Certainly, the situation is deeply affected by the events and the stanch positions of either side, particularly the Western and the Russian side. So in the near future, which means in the forthcoming months, is not envisageable a reversal of the distancing that has been signaled by both Russia and the United States and Europe on the issue of Ukraine.
The Russian official added that the current crisis has provided a unique opportunity to get rid of, quote, residual illusions. He also added that Moscow will use the crisis to go beyond the paradigm of what he described as friendly absorption, which Moscow says has been produced over and over again since 1992. It refers to a climate in which dominant powers following the collapse of the Soviet Union promised Russia to accept it as a member of advanced Western developed nations.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin has said that the era of the unipolar world is over. His stance is a result of the Ukraine conflict. It is also one of the reasons why Russia believes cooperation with the West is over. Putin says a flaw lies in the very idea that there is a single, albeit strong, power with a limited circle of close states, and this is why there is a new world order taking shape.
It's not a fact that the West and its allies are no longer the hegemon powers at the international stage. Following the war in Ukraine, the West imposed a raft of massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia in a bid to weaken Moscow or to potentially make its economy collapse. The sanctions have hurt Russia's economy, but did not trigger its collapse. On the contrary, Russia's oil and gas revenues have soared over the past few months.
The Western side, with its approach, is also imposing a set of rules which are based on its own interests, although they pretend these rules should be universal. The rest of the world is instead proposing to identify shared rules which may differ in the practice according to the latitude and the cultural experience of the different societies. So this is the existential clash between the two sides.
It's now Western citizens who are paying higher gas and energy prices. The crisis has indeed negatively affected European and North American nations and their economies. It's now widely believed that the U.S. has failed to create a united global front against Russia. The asymmetry of interests and perspectives between Washington and Moscow is unlikely to change anytime soon.
On this, we have to add the fact that the manufacturing capacity of the world has moved from the West to the East, particularly to the Far East, which is Asia. And this weakens considerably the perspectives of the West in long-term confrontation with the rest of the world.
And the latest spat between the United States and China over Taiwan is likely to further strain the relations between the Western-led bloc and the emerging counter-hegemonic alliance. Under these circumstances, emerging powers like Iran, with its vast energy sources and rising military might, can play a pivotal role in the shifting balances between the East and the West.
The United Nations Secretary General says the world is playing with a loaded gun as a new arms race is gaining momentum among global powers. Antonio Guterres made the comment at an annual memorial ceremony marking the 77th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bomb attack on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Guterres also highlighted the need for global nuclear disarmament, saying the only way to eliminate nuclear threats is to have no nuclear weapons at all. He made these remarks as Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and local authorities were also present at the event. In 1945, the United States bombed the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with A-bombs, killing more than 220,000 people. The U.S. is the only country to have used weapons of mass destruction during the war. The UK Central Bank has released a set of bleak numbers saying that the country's national economy could slip into recession for more than a year. The Bank of England has increased interest rates yet again to try and smother soaring inflation. It is the largest rate hike in 27 years in a developed country where people are already grappling with declining living standards. Saidpur Azar reports.
Britain is on the brink of a recession, as deep as the 90s and as long as the 2008 financial crisis, a bleak projection by the country's central bank. The Bank of England says it's trying to stem skyrocketing prices by raising interest rates by half a point to 1.75%, saying the measure couldn't come soon enough.
If we don't bring inflation back to target, bearing in mind the huge scale of the energy shock we're seeing, if we don't bring it back to target, and if we get these so-called second-round effects entering in, it's going to get worse.
It was news that sent a chill among the public, people already feeling the squeeze on their finances.
Leave him out of my home and all the bills on, I have to pay it by myself. I'm on minimum wages as a cleaner, and, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do anyway.
The salary is still the same, and the prices are going up, far too up. That's the reason what I have a concern about this.
The Bank of England predicts the economy is going to shrink, with recession starting this year and lasting all the way through the next. That plus the biggest decline in living standards on record and another sharp rise in household energy bills. The bank pins the eye-watering energy price hike largely on rising gas prices owing to the war in Ukraine. But there are other reasons.
It's a whole plethora of reasons coming together. So you can actually look at the effect of the pandemic, what that impacted on manufacturing and consumerability, global trade and supply chains, and the underlying cost of rising commodities, food and other areas. So this is a Gordian knot of elements coming together. Now, untie that knot, and that's what they're going to have trouble doing.
The writing had already been on the wall. Many experts did warn the UK was behind the curve in dealing with rising inflation. Britons are going to see their energy, fuel, and food bills increase significantly over the next year. Charities are warning of a catastrophe this winter. There's talk of creating warm spaces to provide heated sites for those unable to afford their energy bills.
This deluge of bad economic news comes as the country awaits a new prime minister, and that is a month away. But whoever they may be, their job has just become way harder. Saipur is up London.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. I cry for you in pain. I cry for
aperture.
At the height of the Cold War, the CIA launches a highly classified, top secret research program into the covert use of biological and chemical agents. In simulated attacks on enemy populations, entire cities throughout America are contaminated with bacteria, exposing millions of Americans to germ warfare. But the real focus of the research is on mastering the art of mind control. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. LSD had become one of the CIA's key interests for its brain warfare program. As the agency theorized, it could be useful in interrogations. Mind control experiments generally centered around behavior modification via electroshock therapy, hypnosis, polygraphs, radiation, and a variety of drugs, toxins, and chemicals. Now, these experiments relied on a range of test subjects, some who freely volunteered, some who volunteered under coercion, and some who had absolutely no idea that they're involved in a sweeping defense research program. And what was the extent of these brainwashing experiments? How did the CIA use unconsenting people as guinea pigs in thousands of different experiments? Join us on Aperture for your answers on CIA covert experiments.
August 16, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. In Pont-Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. The first dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont-Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Alberelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Albarelli then made the link with the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont-Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont-Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps. Notably, horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946, in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved. And afterwards, the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? Do you think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came in this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service. Lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus, long held responsible for the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD. And the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made, and if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't, and so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out, therefore we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So The whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain, or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound doesn't make that much difference. Pont Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety-producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well-balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, or brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself? These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. That's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear listeners, my sisters and brothers from all around the world, welcome to For a Better Life. This is IRIB English Radio. I hope wherever you are, you're doing well. Welcome to another session of Literature Engaged with the Religion. So we were discussing the story of Ashura and what happened in Karbala. And we talked about the literature that has been enriched with so much of poetry and stories that are so passionate and so full of emotions. These poetry are usually in the form of elegies or in the form of what they call as lamentations or something that is mournful and has got the characteristics of the tragedy in itself as well. So in the previous session, we went through a piece of a book that I introduced to you. It is Karbala and Ashura by Ali Hussein Jalali. And we said that there are plenty of incidents in this book that you could see different aspects of human nature that has been clearly outlined for you. As the reader, when you go through the pages of this book, you would see plenty much of nice features attributed to Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. Of course, it is not just attributed, it is the truth. But through the words of an author, of a poet, who has not been there, perhaps because the writer of this book has actually gone through 14 centuries further of that incident of who's been writing this. So after 14th century, still there are some poets and writers who could do plenty much of justice to what happened there. They use their emotions, their power of writing in order to write such beautiful pieces. Well, you see, in past, the people who study literature are familiar with the idea of muses. Poets and writers believed that there are some sort of muses that would come to their help, and then through the use of those muses, through the benefit and blessing of those muses, these writers and poets would fall into a sort of a slip, and then they would write down whatever that comes to their mind. But what happens in Islamic heritage is that there is no muse, and all is the power of the writer and of the poet that has been bestowed upon him as a blessing by Allah himself. So we believe that when such beautiful words and poems and melodies come out, there must be a spiritual power behind it. Of course, God has provided these people with a sort of blessing that is not very much common for every single person. That was just a point for the poets and the writers of these sort of spiritual pieces that are full of emotion and that show you so much regarding the human nature and human essence. Allah, Allah, Subhanallah, Allah. Allah, Allah, Allah. This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Allah, Allah, walhamdulillah. Oh, ya Allah, subhanallah, Allah. You can listen to us at parstoday.com/en. If you have any suggestion, our email is englishradio@irib.ir. So now let's go back to the piece that I read for you. It was about Shimr coming to Imam Hussein alayhi salam's camp and calling upon his relatives who are Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas and his brothers, because they had a sort of a relativity between them. So he wanted to give them clemency, and then Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas just rejected him. Of course, there would be no shock that he would reject him, because he is the most loyal brother in the world. If loyalty had an image, then it would have been manifested itself in the picture of Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam. Aside from his loyalty, we could see the manner of a brother toward his brother. When he has been called by Shimr, he didn't answer him at the first place, because he knew that his brother is there, and of course he had got nothing to do with that guy. So what happened is that he listened to his brother, and if it wasn't about his brother's order to go and see what he's going to say, he would have never gone out of that camp in order to have that negotiation with that guy. Of course, it was not a negotiation, because this brother's point of view was totally clear, and he knew where he's standing, and he would have never compromised his beliefs and his love that he had for his brother with any sort of clemencies. So he was the one who was about to back his brother up. He was the power of his brother, and he was actually the thing that brought all his army together. So he was the strength of his army. Therefore, it is very obviously that he would have never listened to that clemency sort of a thing and negotiation that happened in there. But it was just an answer to his brother's call, you know. Imam Hussein alayhi salam asked him to go, and he went there. This is not the first time that the manner of a brother is clarified. We see throughout their life, he has never addressed his brother, but as just calling him by his name. Since he's his imam, he is trying to just respect him as a obedient brother who knows that his brother is the imam of every single creature in this world. So much of respect and so much of manner toward his brother shows how respectful and how full of modesty sort of a person he was. So as you can see through literature, so much of these sort of manners have been passed down to us. So the literature of Ashura is not just a matter of telling you a story that happened 14th century ago. It is more of that. It is a school of thought. It is teaching you so much of things. So it is not just a mournful poem that you hear and you shed tears upon it. It is a school of thought that makes you think. It is just like enlightening every single creature in order to have insight. And through those tears that comes to your eyes, you start thinking about the truth behind the story that happened in there. As I just told you, these poets have got this spiritual power in order to share with us this spiritual point of views. So at the same time that they are so touching, so moving, and so heartbreaking, and they cause those tears to gather in your eyes, at the very same time, these poems are meant to make you think and dig deeper and go between the lines of every single part of this story and learn. Because, you know, these stories are not... In literature, we have these didactic form of writings that would teach you very much directly. But what happens in the stories like the story of Karbala is that it is not didactic in a direct way. You go through that story with all your heart, and then you get the main ideas through a journey that you already have been so emotional, and you even have tears upon your cheeks. So it happens by the way of your spirit, by the way of your soul and your heart. And that's the beauty of the literature of Ashura. So this is all the time that we had for today. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.